David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 366. I'm your cosmically aware host, Steve Raker, the one who knows, lodged down in the world-renowned comic book bunker, where I'll be joined shortly by the other manifestations of the Tribunal, Andrew the L.A. Rabbit and WWX Kevin, to present some recent reads and then follow up on our New Warriors bit from last episode by delving into the publishing history of The Torpedo. Marvel Noise is a podcast proudly sponsored by nobody. You can find, stream, and download episodes new and old at marvelnoise.com and get new episode announcements, see cover galleries, and otherwise interact with the show on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Marvel Noise is hosted by the gracious and awesome Deliberate Noise Network, where many other fine podcasts can be found, including our sister show, Indie Comic Book Noise, where the guys and I talk about what indie books we're digging on. Let's get to it. All right. Got Kevin and Andrew here. Wanted to mention a couple of just quick recent reads. I picked up the one-shot, the Morbius Bond of Blood, that I didn't know what it was when I pre-ordered it, but was happy to see that it's one of those Ralph Macchio... written one-shots that have popped up here and there over the past few years. And, I mean, Ralph Macchio was a assistant editor and then an editor and sometimes writer all through the 80s and into the 90s at Marvel. One of those last editors that had, like, a good contact with Steve Ditko and that Steve would work for, that kind of a thing. And, no, he's not the Karate Kid Ralph Macchio. He's the Marvel Comics Ralph Macchio.
And, oh, I thought he was Ultimate Comics, Ralph Macchio.
And he's popped up doing these one-shots recently, and this Morbius one was really entertaining, written by him with art by Tom Riley, who gives it a kind of a, you know, almost like a Chris Somney-type look, although he's got his own vibe to it. And it's a good little story of they go through... Morbius's origin, and he has a brother or an uncle or something that he killed, and the son of, I think it was his brother because it's his nephew, has a rare blood disease, and so does Morbius, right? So he thinks he might be able to figure it out, but he realizes the person who has figured it out is incarcerated, and he is a doctor. Dr. Zabo, if that name rings a bell, and certainly he negotiates with him, if you bring me the serum that'll let me turn back into Mr. Hyde, then I will give you this, the mix you up a dose of the serum that'll help save your nephew. So he does. Mr. Hyde becomes Hyde. Morbius injects his nephew with the serum, and it doesn't go well. And then you get a nice face-off between Morbius and Mr. Hyde.
Weird.
I know that's a little more spoilery than usual for recent books, but figuring it's one of these outlying one-shots that you're probably not going to pick up unless you hear something that's particularly interesting about it. So, there you go.
You know, I didn't know Hyde wasn't Hyde. So that's good for me to know. I didn't know he had been permanently turned back to his civilian boring form.
It's easier to hold them that way.
Probably. You know what's another one of those books that you might not have thought about? From IDW, I guess, technically, right, Steve?
Right.
The Marvel Action Chillers. I guess this was supposed to be a Halloween thing, but... I mean, I'll tell you, I didn't get my issues at Halloween.
Yeah.
So I don't know what kind of hiccups went on there, but we eventually got four issues of this series. And I do enjoy, the reason I picked this up primarily was I do enjoy some Whitley writing from that Unstoppable Wasp series that I was pretty captivated by.
Okay, and that's why she appears in this series.
Yeah, so that was fun to see characters like that again, because they're not always out there prominently in a lot of stories.
What this is a it's a all ages 4-issue series, Marvel Chillers, that is part of that Marvel Action line that they've subbed out to IDW for their all ages books.
Yeah.
Wait, Kevin, so you made me read the Marvel Chillers from 1975, Modred the Mystic, instead?
Oh,
I feel like I wasted my time.
Sorry about that, Andrew.
How dare you?
Yeah, I guess they are playing on an old title there.
But it's Doctor Strange and the... what is that? That Riri Williams... What's her code name now? The Iron Man protege.
Ironheart.
Yeah. That's sort of like the... what do you call that? Like, that's the overarching story.
Yeah.
But then every issue they give you, like, another story with, like, maybe Elsa Bloodstone or someone.
Yep. But done in the Marvel Action all ages style.
Yeah. But I've noticed a lot of details sort of seep in from the... regular, what we would think of as the regular Marvel universe, like especially with like Unstoppable Wasp, like I have a think tank we can go to, stuff like that. But we're at the school instead. I had to laugh that the first issue has an appearance as Emo.
Yep.
And then the name of the book, I mean, that had me cracking up too. So yeah, these are I wouldn't say you necessarily want to go out of your way for these, but they're certainly fun and enjoyable comics.
Speaking of Zemo making an appearance, your boy Joe Kelly has a new comic on the racks that I thought of you when I started reading. It's Nonstop Spider-Man #1 with him writing and Chris Bacalo, or Bacalo, however you prefer, being the artist. There are some really interesting panels in this, but the sequential art aspect of his artwork is starting to become lost on me. Like, this was a hard read for me. But the backup feature was what really caught my eye, drawn in a more classic style by Dale Eaglesham and featuring Baron Zemo being a real badass too. You'd love it, Kevin.
I can't picture him being in a Spider-Man book exactly.
They didn't meet.
They didn't meet?
Yet.
Huh. That's a good creative team anyways.
I got another one. I read Daredevil #28. It's the middle.
That's right.
It's like the middle of this current Daredevil arc where he has willingly gone to prison and Elektra is replacing him as Daredevil in Hell's Kitchen.
Yeah.
This issue 28 had no Elektra in it, and it all focused on Daredevil in prison, and it's written by Chip Zdarsky with art by Marco Cicchetto, which is fantastic art. He's just continuing to deserve the accolades. He's really leveled up in the last few years.
He's a superstar.
And this issue is like a day in the life kind of in prison, and it's not really one day, though maybe it actually is, but it's the goings on in prison. He's like having to meet with the psychologist there and then go back out into the milieu, as it were, and experience what's going on, and then kind of touch base back with the therapist and having a different view on what she had said previously based on what happens.
And it's kind of usual prison goings on, fights in the shower and all that sort of business. But it is done really well. We've seen Daredevil in prison. We've seen the ultimate superhero in prison stories with the Punisher being in prison.
Yeah, but
this manages to be not necessarily fresh, but definitely still entertaining.
Totally entertaining.
They should have gotten Mike Zeck to do the covers. It's a little tribute to the Punisher in prison from his 80s limited series.
You want the bullet holes in the cover or something?
All right, now one more, Kevin.
Okay. So we got X-Men Legends, All New Mutant Milestone. Well, I don't know how much of a milestone. But anyhow, yeah, this is the Adam X Extreme.
This is a new series that's going to focus on different... It's basically... Do you remember the old X-Men Unlimited title from the 90s?
I was thinking about that. Also, like, sort of like backup.
Also, with Brett Booth art, I think some of those issues were... This really felt like it's an oversized... out of X-Men history, new story. But it's giving writer Fabian Nicieza a opportunity to do what Roger Stern did when he got his hands back on the Hobgoblin and had a chance to fix the continuity there so that it more matched what he originally intended for the character that he created. And that's what's happening here regarding Adam X.
What were those issues? Were there Marvel Vault issues? You know, like they had a Doctor Strange.
Yes.
Old story, the Thunderbolts old story. Like they did, like... Fabian's been involved in some of these things before.
Yeah, but those Vault stories were, for the most part, all old inventory stories, which were...
Yeah, I think they were all created. I mean, maybe they ink it or color it. But...
I mean...
Yeah, there was a bad month where they had production delays, and they were like, well, that's never going to happen again, and they did a new wave of inventory stories and wanted to get them all out, so they did.
Yeah. Yeah, this story would have happened.
Should have happened.
Yeah, but didn't happen.
But it's newly created, right? This isn't old story. This is...
Yeah.
So there you go.
And it's funny that the art kind of looks like of that era. I'm not quite sure... should I make it a Cronin joke? I looked at that on the cover and I was just like, oh...
I mean, say you're the Fabster, right? And you're sitting around and you get the call and it's like, how would you like to come back and revisit the characters that you wrote 30 years ago now almost?
Yeah.
Wow, gosh, that sounds like a lot of work. Man, you could make it as many issues as you want. 2 issues, 3 issues? Oh, all right, now we're talking. And you get to work with artists you're familiar with from that time and you can... touch upon the character you created. Remember that whole third Summers brother thing? And now that they made it, Jason Aaron did that awful thing with the Emperor Vulcan being the third Summers brother. Oh, I hated that.
I think you want to throw Ed Brubaker under the bus.
Oh, yeah, it was, wasn't it?
It was where they killed off Banshee and everything.
Yeah, I'm sorry. my apologies to Aaron. that was bad. But this is because they had already done enough groundwork in those old issues, and then there was that great issue with the crashed plane where the Scott and Alex Summers' grandfather, I guess, is crashed in the plane, and Adam X is there, and they kind of realize that they're related.
Yeah.
I don't know. It made it seem like, oh, he's the third Summers brother, and I think that's what it was always intended to be. Yeah. So now this is the opportunity for them to play around with that and make it so.
Well, it's funny. The Sinister makes a comment back then where he's, like, you could interpret it as not one Summers brother. Like, there's multiple Summers brothers.
Oh, no. Is this going to be like everyone's a brother of Thor?
funny enough, here we are, fourth Summers brother.
And Balder is the fifth Summers brother.
Well, until the Smothers brothers are the Summers brothers.
Mom always liked you best, Andrew.
I mean, I don't think this is going to convince anyone to go back and read some 90s X-Men comics, but if that was your era, I think this is entertaining.
You should have, when you had the Unlimited segment, you should have covered X-Men Unlimited on Unlimited, Devin.
What?
When you did the Unlimited segments for Marvel Noise, you should have covered X-Men Unlimited from the 90s.
Was it on
the Unlimited?
I'm not sure if it was. Oh, maybe the new one. The newer
one. No, the one from the 90s. It's on Unlimited.
But was it back then? I'm not entirely sure.
Unlimited's on Unlimited?
Yeah. It's like the
infinite
loop.
And so on.
Yeah. It took me a while for my brain to wrap my head around that one.
So last episode, we did a New Warriors bit that included 1992's issue 28, the first appearance of Turbo, a female teen in a familiar-looking tight blue union suit with wind turbines on her wrists and ankles and a kooky angled helmet with a visor. And this caught my notice back in the day because I knew that outfit. It's the Torpedo. And I always liked the Torpedo. In my first year of ever buying comics regularly off the racks as a 5-year-old in 1975, I had bought a few issues of Daredevil with the Torpedo. So, who is this guy and where'd he go? It's time for the publishing history of the Torpedo. So, the Torpedo first appeared in Daredevil issues 126 and 127 back in the fall of 1975. And like I said, I had these issues. They were written by Marv Wolfman. Actually, he was the writer and editor. Uh-oh, right? That's always a warning sign. With art by Bob Brown and Klaus Janson.
I have a small side divergence. For the modern issues on Marvel Unlimited, we know where the description comes from, right? But where does the description come from for issues like this? Like 126, it'll say, Torpedo's biggest threat in battle may not be Daredevil, but watching out for that wall too late. Like, who's writing that? Where are they getting this from?
That is pretty
bad. I assume it's the intern has a good time.
Oh, maybe.
Once they're formatting all these files and everything. But, geez, I don't know. Like, who would ever mess with someone's hard digital work in the process of uploading? Yeah, I couldn't think of any podcasting examples of someone who receives a pristine collection of a file format and notes and then proceeds to monkey with them before they upload, Kevin. Boy, I can't imagine that scenario. Mr. Hypocrite.
A bunch of these issues are on Marvel Unlimited, but when we get to the ROM ones, spoiler, those ones aren't, obviously. So, Daredevil 126 and 127, these issues really follow the stories of three individuals. There's Daredevil, of course, it's his book, and he's in his pre-Frank Miller, flippant, almost snotty in his presentation. He's like, really critical of his friends, but he's still the hero once he has the suit on.
What about Foggy, though? Is this like he's been slimming down and he's like going for important positions, like the district attorney? Like, I don't know this Foggy.
Yeah, he's like a political hack at this time.
Yeah.
This is a weak spot in my Daredevil history, too, so I'm glad to revisit it. I feel that I like a lot of Wolfman stuff, but some of these titles, I feel like it didn't showcase his skills. And these Daredevil ones read kind of flat, too.
How about?
I mean, because I grew up with the Daredevil that's going through a bad time, the Frank Miller. And then you know, the Lee Weeks, JR, and Ascenti, like, just having a rough go of it. So to read these ones where it's kind of flip or whatever, but having not read this, what freaked me out, Super Steve, is the real first appearance that's in this.
Oh, I know. Well, we'll get
like
to
that
it.
Blew my mind, because I hadn't thought about that character in since those issues came out. So
ditto, and it changed my mind as to feeling bad about what Miller did to the character. But
is that really the character? I was just like, I'm like, because I don't think they mentioned the last name. Well, so I was like,
oh,
is
yeah.
that the
oh,
one?
Yeah. Oh yeah. So let me get into this three characters thing, because then it's easier to wrap your head around the rest of the story. There's Daredevil. There's the Torpedo in his rocket suit, who's a guy on a mission. He breaks into a bank and steals some papers from a safe deposit box, but leaves the money. And he's really goal-directed, but when Daredevil gets in his way, he basically has to go through him, but he really doesn't want anyone to get hurt in the process of him completing his tasks. But he's willing to do it. And then there's Brock Jones, who's a former Super Bowl-winning quarterback. You know, he's looking for that after-sports identity and a second career. And
is he ever?
Just hating being like a middle management guy for an insurance company, dying for something more. But he is heroic in his own way. Like, he would have saved a kid from being hit by a car if Daredevil hadn't swooped in like a jerk. So Daredevil engages Torpedo after hearing him blow completely through a police car outside his window. And they tussle. I mean, the Torpedo is tough. He's got like these rocket punches that can shatter walls, or I assume, you know, bones.
I love the aesthetic design, because what it does, it looks like he's wearing Elizabethan ruffs around his wrists,
yeah,
and kind of these jet boots with rudders on them.
Yeah, it really
and then
does.
Because the mask is almost like a jester, it's pulled back to give fins for speed, and then goggles on. And he usually flies close to the ground. Kind of looks like a torpedo, basically, which is, I'm sure. My only issue is, in and of itself, the costume design is fine. But having a guy in all red against a guy in all blue is less visually interesting. Like, I wouldn't have minded some... He doesn't need to be wearing stripes or anything. But I felt like the two monochrome union suits made for a less interesting tussle.
Good observation, for sure. True dat. And, like, the Torpedo regrets having to rocket punch Daredevil in the face, but he's willing to do so, and elevator doors open up right behind Daredevil, and there is, like, Brock Jones stepping out, coming, like, down from a day at work, grinding away at the desk he hates sitting at. And he almost walks into the punch, but the Torpedo pulls back, and it ended up, like, knocking into the supports of the building and brings a whole bunch of rubble right down on top of them. And they're all, like, smashed up by the rubble. Brock is the one who's able to free himself first, and the Torpedo, like... dies in his arms, but not before he tells Brock the meaning of his mission. So Brock swears to the dying man to take up his cause and do what he asked him to do.
And then you get an embarrassing moment in Daredevil history.
Brock changes clothes with the Torpedo, donning his uniform to complete the mission, just in time for Daredevil to wake and get a cop and accuse the Torpedo, now Brock, of murdering that man who is actually the Torpedo, but he thinks was Brock stepping out of the... You know what I mean? I guess Daredevil can't see that they have different color hair, right? So,
well, yeah, that's what he says. And then Daredevil's like, I can't confirm this.
Well, I think that Brown and Jansen do a really great job of having a dynamic action, give and take, and the care, like some of those rocket punches, and like I said, I love him flying. But I don't think they do a great job of placing location at times. The big fight happens in the lobby of a building, and it looks like an art museum or something. He comments on, like, the abstract sculpture and everything, but it had a very surreal battlefield origin that I thought could have used some cleanup. But I do like, generally, the fights. The other thing that's weird is, okay, so they swap clothes. That means, and they draw it this way, Brock takes his clothes off, puts his clothes on the dead guy's body, which seems like there was a bunch of time there that I could see him taking the outfit, but I like that he bothered to, like, put his shirt and his jacket, because remember, he's at work.
Yeah. Well, he wanted to dress the corpse, basically. That is pretty bad. So now it's Brock Jones in the torpedo suit. He hasn't mastered how to use it yet or anything, but now he is fending off and escaping Daredevil and the police while also aiming to complete his mission. And Foggy turns up for Matt that the guy who died, the original torpedo, was a Russian scientist and the brother of the owner of that safe deposit box that the torpedo robbed. So that doesn't, something is off here, and it's starting to add some credibility to the torpedo story. So when the Daredevil and the torpedo next tussle, Brock explains as they fight that he's not the same guy. He never even met that guy.
Well, a couple of brief comments, if I may. One, thank you, Marv, for not giving original torpedo Marvel Comics foreigner English speak. But I guess that would have revealed that they were separate people. Second of all, I thought that Mr. Super Hearing would have noticed that their voices sound different. Unless they just happen to, you know, you'd think all your, because look, Brock can't go three panels without having a football metaphor or other, I'm crossing the touchdown line and all that stuff. So you'd think all those mannerisms, the way he holds his body, his posture, you know, Daredevil would pick up on that. I thought it was a little weird. But hey, you know, you need your heroes to fight, right, Steve? It's a Marvel comic.
So the torpedo, while he's fighting Daredevil, explains that before the original torpedo died, he gave him some papers that prove that he was a Russian scientist whose uncle in the USA promised to buy his freedom if he designed a super commando suit that could rival Iron Man's. So he built the torpedo suit, but when he gets to the States, he learns that his family, particularly this uncle, had evil intents and purposes, so he made him an inferior suit and stole the plans for the original along with the original suit. And their fight leads into a family's house who are home. It's kind of horrifying that they're like dodging debris and furniture and really the utter destruction of their property, and that's what finally ends hostilities when they realize they're putting these people at risk around them.
Now, in contrast to the building lobby, it was obviously a story point, so that was probably stress, but here I thought they made great use of the house as the setting and props and the fight, and it like really put me in this setting very much. And like you say, they're dodging fallen stuff and dynamic panel composition. This fight was really well done, and we're gonna see if there's anything that drives Brock Johnson other than football metaphors. It's that his own power is scary and has a price. Yeah, so those are kind of the two things that, and he hates insurance.
And the torpedo basically gives Daredevil the papers at the end and says he doesn't care anymore and flies off. Now, even better, the elephant in the room here. So this is how Heather walks into Matt's life? She just stumbles into his room that her ex-boyfriend used to live there and keeps coming back, and this is... Are you kidding me?
It is rather strange.
It's a character I hadn't thought about since those books came out in the 80s, and it just blew... I was like, is this the same? And then you're like, wait, is this... Holy cat. Like, because, spoiler, the character... I mean, maybe she's been brought back, but she dies in the 80s, the stories I'm familiar with. So I hadn't thought of, you know, you'd have no reason to go back and think about the old days with her. But yeah, it really threw me. She's this portrayed as like a complete idiot hustler kind of, who just wants the next man who can provide for. Yeah, not a flattering portrayal of this, of Heather at all.
And in the next episode with the torpedo, which is Daredevil 134... the next year in the spring of 1976, which I also happened to pick up off the racks. I had to have this one. How could I not, with a cover looking from behind Daredevil as two torpedoes attack him? And that makes sense, right? Because there's Brock, the torpedo, and then there was an original torpedo, although that's not where this story goes at all. But as a kid, also, I was like, oh, that's cool, the two torpedoes. Yeah.
Most submarines have two torpedo tubes, too, to fit in with his...
There you go. But no, but also, it was like how Heather, in just a few issues later, from 7 issues from 127 to 134, she's totally integrated into Matt's life, and yeah, he, like, loves her and everything, and I'm like, this is crazy, and... I reiterate what I said before when we hadn't yet named the character, that I kind of feel not as bad about how badly Miller treated her during his run now, because she's awful, awful.
Do you see how Matt treats her, though? He uses a nerve pinch on her.
That is pretty bad. They're on a Central Park-like carriage ride, and he needs to find out what the commotion is. So he incapacitates her with like a Spock Vulcan nerve punch thing to cut their date short because she doesn't feel well. It's awful. Hilarious. All right.
Oh, Matt.
So this issue is also written and edited by Wolfman with pencils by Bob Brown. This time inks by Jim Mooney, who I think is a really underappreciated Bronze Age artist. And yes, I know he... worked us in the Silver Age and was prolific and all that, but I think that his Bronze Age work was where he's underappreciated. Anyway, so it wasn't the two torpedoes that we already know. The villain of this issue is the Chameleon. All right, so now it makes sense. The Chameleon robs a bank, and the chatter from the chase alerts Brock Jones in his corner office, who first resists the urge and then dons the torpedo suit once more.
He makes more football allusions than NFL super pro does.
He does.
He would have made a better NFL super pro.
Yeah, I have no idea how they rumbled his secret identity.
Daredevil interrupts after taking care of Heather. Interrupts the torpedo just as he's about to apprehend the Chameleon, who of course looks like an innocent bystander running away. Not that Daredevil can see him. That didn't really make sense to me. But anyway, the Daredevil makes the mistake of, you can't be chasing that guy. And Daredevil consistently gets it wrong when it comes, you know, to play with the torpedo.
It does feel like they just had the two guys meet and fight bit. But I guess that's the thing with the Chameleon. Like, he's not going to have, like, a 6-page punch-up. Like, that's not his skill set. So he does need to cause the distraction and have the heroes fighting. But, yeah, maybe a different guy to get them to team up. Because you kind of want to see him team up.
And the new gear that the Chameleon has is something that, like, instantly changes his clothes or something like that, Kevin. So when he tries to lose the Torpedo and Daredevil in a crowd, he can do so by, you know, really changing his identity a bunch of different times, almost like a shapeshifter.
Yeah, I wonder if it's sort of like the Mystique thing where you don't get everything. Like, you will look the part, but you don't have, like, the powers.
Once Daredevil, you know, gets a bead on who the Chameleon is and what the deal is, though, he can identify him by that heartbeat. So then when the rooftop scene from the cover occurs, two torpedoes, one of them fake, Daredevil totally knows which one is the Chameleon and is able to take him out.
If only he had some fake turbines.
No, his really are the Victorian ruffles.
Exactly.
Yeah, the Chameleon, I know, classic Spider-Man villain, but he seemed like he didn't have a lot of jam, and the lack of an interesting character design made him not one of my top people. I also feel like he tries the same gig in two pages in a row. Like, he's the fake torpedo who Daredevil saw through, and then he's a fake news agent to blend in. And I'm like, you know, he just rumbled you the first time. Like,
a year later, in the fall of 1977, the Torpedo would show up in two issues of Marvel Premiere, number 39 and 40. And Marvel Premiere was a bi-monthly book that allowed creators to flesh out supporting characters or side characters, or like build a mythology for them, sort of like a pilot for a series. And
what a great cover. Man, I don't remember this issue. I remember that cover.
Marv Wolfman again is the writer editor, with Bob Brown again providing pencils, and now Alan Milgram doing the inks and the cover.
Yeah, great cover. Again, Marv, like, I don't know. Maybe these ex-football guys really do talk in all football speak, but it would have been a long slog if they get this guy his own series.
These issues pit the Torpedo against the jetpack-wearing Rocketeer gang. All right. Stick with me here. A guy serendipitously obtains a flying rocket device that he was never meant to have, but becomes a hero all the while a rich mystery man is trying to recover it. Wait, isn't that very Dave Stevens Rocketeer?
Mm-hmm. Don't forget, Steve, his wife is a model. So
and the gang's name is the Rocketeer, but do you know that this is like 5 years before the Rocketeer?
Yeah.
Well, the setting's very not like this is current times.
I know, but isn't that weird?
The Rocketeer gang, again, with the monochrome, like, all green thing. Like, we can have some color in here, people. Some colorists get paid, too, and they do an excellent job. So, I mean, I guess there's, like, accents to their equipment, but I don't know.
The funky-shaped helmet sense. With the fin? I mean, do you think Dave Stevens liked the turbo? Like the torpedo here? And the Rocketeer gang, this wasn't their first appearance. They had been appearing over in Marv Wolfman's Daredevil also and providing him some trouble. So they migrated over here too, along with the Torpedo.
Did Nova fight some guys like this?
A Marv Wolfman book, so I wouldn't be surprised. So here they're presented as working for the big man who is trying to recover the torpedo suit.
Not the big man, though.
Frederick Foswell?
Yeah, exactly.
We see Brock's family at home. He's got a wife and two rugrat kids, a house in the burbs. But, oh, God, does he hate that insurance job?
He doesn't want to be a jobber.
Really? Not meant for that 9-to-5 job. The Rocketeers chase him down, and he has to relive his, you know, his Uncle Ben heroes have responsibilities moment when they accidentally trash a store that reminds him of trashing that family's house back in Daredevil 127. Having learned nothing, though, their next encounter has them totally wrecking part of a Con Edison nuclear power plant, resulting in a dangerous buildup of a nuclear pressure, and the place is going to blow and take Manhattan with it.
My favorite moment of this is, okay, they're destroying the place. Well, first of all, well done, team. They reset the table. We got that Bob Brown was an ex-football guy, always talks in footballs, has a loving family, hates his job, worried about doing too much damage. Like, those are the elements, and they explain his outfit and all that stuff. Well done. So they're destroying this thing. All the technicians flee the scene. Like, if this is a nuclear explosion, how far do they think they're going to... First of all, I appreciate their dedication to try and fix the problem. Like, they're like, oh, it's broken, I'm going to get out of here, not tell anyone, not sound anyone. Like, yeah, maybe we can get in our car and get out of the New York, greater New York area before everyone dies. Like, man, these are, talk about a bunch of Homer Simpsons working at this place.
And how about the Rocketeers themselves? They knock out Brock at the end of the issue, but then choose to just leave him there to die and not recover the suit.
Well, don't forget, they had knocked him out before and then left a trail from the fun. I'm like, well, if he knocked him out, why didn't he just do it there? Like,
jeez. Meanwhile, his wife keels over at home, sees a doctor, and learns that she's pregnant with Rugrat number 3. The torpedo reveals that the original torpedo told him before he died that the suit had its own nuclear generation system or something, so he figures it can handle the stress, and he chooses to physically close the circuit until the surge dissipates.
Some great panels here, man. They do a killer job with the... like, this is like your classic Spidey has to overcome a physical feat to show he's a real hero. So I like this whole, where he grabbed their giant cables and he's cutting through the insulation to grab them and leaning back and yelling and smashing stuff. Yeah, yeah, well done. I mean, it's, even by superhero science, it's pretty ludicrous stuff, but still, well portrayed. And like, the ending result is, it doesn't blow up, it just, like, vanishes.
Well, all the power goes into the suit, and he's got to release it. And releasing it vaporizes the hopefully evacuated entire facility. I mean, it's just gone, Andrew, gone.
Well, no one needed that facility anyways.
And this gives the police a reason to chase the torpedo now, because he's caused all this destruction.
And then I guess the other style choice, and Steve, maybe you're more familiar with Daredevil this area, for our mysterious bad guy, like, they could show his face. I don't know this character, right?
Right.
It's not like it's going to be revealed to be Foswell or something, right? Like Osborn. Unless he was a big character in the Daredevil books or something.
No, nope.
They do keep him in the shadows, and then they're revealed, and I'm like, who's this guy? Like,
well, they do explain. The bald, not so much in the shadows anymore, big guy behind his desk isn't too happy about the turn of events. And he's got his whole bunch of thugs there and sends them out. And was one of the... is that Luke Cage there?
I love the yellow shirt. That is classic. Well, don't mistake his bulk for fat, Steve.
And Brock's football trophy, really... I mean, it looks like the Silver Surfer playing football, doesn't it? Playing quarterback. Got the board and everything.
They do call it the Super Bowl, but everything else is different. And I'm like, he played on this. Well, the other thing I thought that was a bad decision was they give the year that he, you know, did this courageous Super Bowl win. And I'm like, you should have just said I played a few years ago.
Yep.
And then it's eternally evergreen rather than
Super Bowl
claiming
12.
A particular Super Bowl. Because then you're like, well, that doesn't, you know, that makes me feel bad because it happened to be that he's claiming the 72 Super Bowl, you know, the Miami-Washington one. And I'm like,
Nobody remembers who quarterbacked that
team. Is he Bob Greasy or whatever? Like.
Right. So Greasy, I mean, Brock realizes that the original Torpedo told him something else before he... I mean, how long? Did they really have that much time? He's giving him papers.
Time to dress and undress.
He's, like, giving him his passwords. He's, like, telling him all kinds of stuff. Jesus. So the papers that the Torpedo stole from the safe box have his uncle's, the big man's, name on it. And he's a high-powered U.S. senator that Brock totally recognizes. So Brock...
This guy looks like he's... does not look like he's doing a lot of TV appearances to win his senator seat.
Yeah, he's a like... tough-looking dude. He looks like a Crusher Creel type. Brock first meets the senator as Brock Jones about adding star power to the senator's re-election campaign, but then sneaks back as the Torpedo to break into the big man's safe and get some more evidence of his group's plot to take over the country with their rocket commandos. The Rocketeers show up and attack him in the big man's office. Yeah, it's a tough turn of events. The Torpedo uses his rocket punch, but gets his elbow kicked back, so the rocket punch punches his own self in the face, knocking himself out, making me think of every big brother who said to his little brother, "Why are you hitting yourself? Why are you hitting yourself?"
Well, I do appreciate that they didn't go through the belabored, like, I'm a new superhero, I don't know my powers. I mean, a little bit of that, but I feel like sometimes they really lean into the... And I get in the quote-unquote real world, you'd have to learn your powers and everything. But it's a story we just see so much. It's nice that he can be a novice hero without a lot of the hair pulling and teeth grinding about how am I ever going to figure out how to shoot these webs or whatever.
The Torpedo awakens at the senator's mansion. They can't get the suit off him.
I thought that was a nice narrative touch to explain why they didn't just do him in the office. Like, he's trying to reason why to bring him back to this death trap. And I'm like, okay, good. We need a reason, however crappy it is.
They string him up and torture him. And, you know, he's strung with his arms and legs out wide in manacles. Like, we often see heroes stuck. But he breaks free.
Don't forget his catchphrase, Steve. Touchdown.
Yep. Touchdown, I did it. And he did it for his family, just like all of those touchdowns. After whooping the assembled Rocketeers, the Torpedo goes after the big man and says, I won't even dirty my hands on scum like you, Senator. Not when I can just stamp my foot and let the shockwave bowl you over. But then in the very next panel, he grabs him with his hands. But it's to throw the big man into the big console, which causes a big self-destruction sequence. And a Torpedo escapes and leaves the senator to take the big boom.
Also, I'm unsure. We have a nice insurance metaphor that... If you don't like the football one, there are a few insurance where he relates the things through that lens work as well.
Usually he kicks himself for doing so, though. What am I saying? Now I'm thinking of policies. But the big man, he's not dead. He emerges from the rubble, shaking his fist at the sky. Brock goes home, learns about his wife's new pregnancy, and they have metaphoric hot chocolate with the kids.
It does leave off like they really were expecting this to move to some more dramatic conclusion. Like, because the senator's like, you know, he attacked a sitting senator.
Yep.
Brock's going to be the one that's in trouble when all this, you know, comes to light and all that. But I guess it never came to light.
Instead, Marv was the one who moved on. The Torpedo would next appear in... the following year, in the summer of 1978, in Defenders 62 and 63, written by David Anthony Kraft, with art by Sal Buscema and Jim Mooney. These couple of issues were part of the Be a Defender for a Day arc, where the Defenders inadvertently advertised for tryouts for new potential members, and a whole bunch of like loner heroes showed up. For everyone from Power Man to Iron Fist to Moon Knight to Captain Ultra, everybody, and it's a crazy characters all over the place romp of an event. And the Torpedo, he's one of the many heroes that shows up, but his only scenes of note are one with him turning down the advances of Hellcat. He's like, sorry, I'm married, and she's like, too bad for you. And then he joins a small group of heroes who decide to try to take down the Hulk, and he gets trashed along with the likes of the Bill Foster, Black Goliath, and Havoc.
I'm glad they chose him. Like, he seemed like a fun... I could see how you might miss when they're filling it. I also didn't realize... Jack of Hearts, I always think of as like an 80s guy. Like, I didn't realize he was like a 70s guy.
Hmm. He didn't get that limited series until the 80s, though, that's for sure. All right, now, this was the highlight of revisiting these... old issues for me as we move to the ROM Space Knight series. ROM ran from the fall of 1979 through 1986, 75 issues and 4 annuals. Back in the later half of the 70s, Marvel was like several times hired to generate interest in upcoming toy lines by like publishing a corresponding comic, but also often serving as writers for the toy companies themselves, creating characters, mythologies, even like motivations and reasons for the characters to be fighting each other. Micronauts, Shogun Warriors, and later G.I. Joe and the Transformers. And the same held true for ROM, that was a blinking, beeping toy put out, but barely, by the We Only Know How to Make Board Games, Not Toys company, Parker Brothers.
I believe the patents on the ROM toy expired about a decade ago, Steve, if you want to go dig up and wire your own toy with his blinking lights and sound effects. Yeah, it looked, I never had the toy, but it looked pretty...
really bad.
Non-articulated and...
really
not bad. Very interesting. And the other thing is with those, I mean, I had like some one-off junk toys. I had a Tobor, that remote control robot that responded to clicking and stuff, but they were all kind of interesting novelties, but they couldn't do a lot after you got them out of the box and did their one or two things with them.
I wonder if the Tobor technology became the clapper years later.
Yeah, because that's what the remote just made a loud clicking, like a crack, like you snap your fingers and that was it. But yeah, Tobor robot backwards.
The bulk of the series ROM was by the creative team Bill Mantlow, Sal Buscema, and Joe Sinnott. And ROM was a space knight from the planet Galador, chasing down the shape-changing, hostile sorcerer race, the Dire Wraths,
who... and it just looks like he's murdering regular people.
That's just it. They've set up shop, they've infiltrated Earth, and they hide as humans, so when ROM blasts them into limbo, anyone who's not in the know thinks that he's killed some innocent humans and that he's the menace.
I feel like he owes a debt to the Silver Surfer. He surrendered his native abilities to be transformed to save his people.
Yes.
He is very emo. Like, he's always pining for the old days. He feels this burden, but it's a tragic one. Like, I mean, not in any design aesthetic. Like, I love the design.
Yep.
The big boxy upper body, I feel, is not something we saw a lot of. And it really gave the character mass and intimidation in a way that was different than just like a Hulk or something. Like, I thought it was a really genius. And like the monochrome, I mean, obviously it's based on the toy, so to some effect, these are natural. It would be bulky because the batteries all went in there and everything. But as a character, it translates well on the page, and the glowing red eyes probably owes a debt to Battlestar Galactica, I'm sure, as well. But... yeah, I thought generally with all those elements, it worked out well. they were able to work as Goofy, Translator, and Limbo Band, like all that stuff that came with the toy, fit into the narrative. Creating this bad guys for him to chase seemed bad. No, they did. Look, 75 issues, it gets hard. It's G.I. Joe Cobra, so they got to mix it up once in a while with some third party mixed in.
He should team up with Beta Ray Bill.
Ooh, that would have been good. Now, that brings us to ROM Space Knight issue 21 in the summer of 1981, where as an 11-year-old, I was already an avid reader of ROM. And, that, I mean, this Milgram cover of ROM being pushed aside by the torpedo, I love it. It's like, move over, ROM, there's a new hero in town. The issue is also is dedicated to Marv Wolfman, the creator of the torpedo, which is cool. So
Marv Wolfman at the time, still alive, by the way.
Yeah, still alive now.
Wasn't some, I don't know when people are going to listen to the podcast. I don't want to put pressure on you to finish this.
Years later, Kevin, Beta Ray Bill did fight alongside the Avengers and Thor and a bunch of other characters when they did the final Dire Wraith War on Earth. When Ditko did the penciling and P. Craig Russell was providing inks, which was interesting. So here the torpedo is moving to Rom's town, Clairton, West Virginia, just as Rom is faced with a conundrum, whether to pursue a lead that suggests that his home planet was destroyed, or stay and continue his war against the Wraiths on Earth and protect Clairton.
Well, Steve, what about Shalbala? Is she still back there waiting for him on Galador?
It's a great time for Brock Jones and family to move in. He quit his insurance job and is taking over coaching at the high school. Makes a lot of sense.
He's still involved in football.
Yeah, that way all his belabored football metaphors will still work out. But I like that it's presumably to hide out from the Rocketeer gang. But as a former Super Bowl MVP, I think that he's going to find he's somewhat more, especially going under his existing name. Like, he didn't change his name or anything. He's still, like, the Super Bowl MVP guy.
But the Rocketeers had tracked him down to his house and attacked him while his family slept. So he's picked up and used the following his dreams thing as an excuse to the family.
And big shout-out to Sal, man.
Yeah.
Underrated. Like, he made ROM in a way that, like, there, yeah, you can say it's a goofy toy character or whatever, but he made that character, and that's, he owns it, set it up, and, like, as far as I'm concerned, everybody's following that, chasing that design and that look.
Brock and Joe Sinnott, too. Inks are real nice in this book. They always were. So they're welcomed into Clairton, but when Brock sees something fly by overhead like a rocket man of some kind, he thinks it's the Rocketeers chasing him here and suits up, but, you know, of course it's ROM.
Well, he's still got to fight. We're still in a Marvel comic, right, Steve? So they still got a hero's got to fight.
And it's the torpedo, so they also have to destroy a lot of private property. And here it's the very high school field and the bleachers and everything that he was going to coach at. Nice going, Ace.
Oh, no.
ROM finally just gives up, and the torpedo stops short of rocket punching his toaster head off. ROM explains his mission, and Brock realizes his suit must be tied to Wraith technology. Cut to the insurance company that Brock used to work at, and half of them are Dire Wraiths, and they're coming for the suit. And they reveal that the torpedo suit was designed to kill ROM in the first place. So how's that for retconning it?
Wow.
Doesn't really seem like it's designed for taking on a space knight.
Well, good thing ROM didn't let him punch him in the face there. It might have really knocked that block right off. In ROM 22, Brock reveals ROM's and his torpedo identity to his family and to the townsfolk in Clairton. And then the Wraith Rocketeers fly into town and attack the elementary school. It's seven pages of ROM and the torpedo cleaning house. It's all out action. I loved this issue as a kid.
Yeah, I always felt that Rom delivered, like, because you're blasting these guys into the limbo zone that could be kind of bloodthirsty in a way, but Rom could still have that holier-than-thou Silver Surfer, like, I'm above all this, like, I'm not really killing them, I'm just sending them to be tortured for all eternity, aren't I a nice guy sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I like that when the heroes really rub in that they're better guys than we are.
In the end, Rom deputizes the Torpedo to watch over Clairton while he investigates the claim that his home planet has been destroyed by trying to get off-world and back to Galador. And then I love the ending here where back at Brock's old insurance company building, his old boss has killed himself and turned to dust as wraiths do. Dirty wraiths. Stinking wraiths. Rom issue 28 from the beginning of 1982 sees Rom and a female space knight named Starshine returning to Earth and to Clairton. And Torpedo seems to have everything pretty much under control, but the wraiths have secretly infiltrated the town somewhat under his nose there.
Now, I'm sure by this point, like, Rom the toy is dead. So oh, they yeah. just go crazy oh, yeah. with these oh, yeah. Space Knight designs. Again, with the monochrome thing, which seems to be... remember, dear listeners, I was reading all these in order. So some of those patterns more jump out about the football and the insurance and the monochrome when you read them. Like, no one would have read these naturally in that order. But I like the designs. I just feel like we can have a little color... But they always do that with metal. I think of the Metal Men and other
yep.
characters. They like that, like, one color per thing. But they get a lot of expressiveness out of, especially Starshine. She has a few disapproving looks on her weird kind of head.
Really weird. Hex nut face.
But she still has hair, like a top knot that comes out. That's fun. And I assume it's metallic because it changes its positioning and everything. Well, yeah, just a fun, crazy sci-fi design. And you're like, yeah, I'm glad. I think if they had toys, I don't know that we would have gotten quite such outlandish designs in the same way.
In issue 28, they deal with everyone disappearing underground. And yep, it's the Mole Man.
Of course.
And that leads to the discovery of the wraiths being in Clairton. And in the melee, one of them kills Starshine.
And no!
She dies in Rom's arms. That was his Shala Ball.
But that's all right, because Rom has moved on. He's been working on this Brandy chick. She's a fine girl.
Since the beginning.
Yeah, and then Brandy's angry emo boyfriend, who's always thought ballooning how much he doesn't like this space knight who came in and stole his girl.
But he's still always been there for Rom too, which is it's put yeah. him in a bad position since the very beginning, and he's tolerated the situation and still done what he could for Rom.
Well, what are you gonna do with that whole setup? Like, he's got a toaster for a head, and I don't think too many other attachments, so well, there's always gonna be a limit on their relationship.
And he was a car guy, so he was like, could help Rom like recharge at the very beginning when he first made it to Earth yeah. and stuff.
He needed new gaskets, I believe.
Right. In Rom 30 from the spring of 1982, Rom treats the Torpedo's visor so he can now detect dire wraiths, which is pretty cool.
No mention from the villain from Hulk number 6. The first Steve Ditko penned Hulk, Steve.
Yeah, well, the Torpedo didn't encounter him at all. That was just what was happening for Rom.
I also love when Rom gets mentioned, they use the Rom Space Knight, like, font and design. Yeah. I'm Rom, trademark Space Knight.
With the new visor on, the Torpedo goes on to patrol, and he encounters the very powerful hybrid being from Rom 17, I think, the ones with the X-Men guest starring. So then in Rom 31 and 32, the Torpedo fights the hybrid but is defeated, and Rom inadvertently frees the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants fresh off their incarceration in Avengers Annual 10, which is the Rogue one with the Michael Golden art. That's a really good one.
Wow.
Rom helps apprehend a few of the Brotherhood, but Mystique, Rogue, and Destiny escape and seek refuge in an old mansion, and it's the mansion where the Hybrid is.
Oh, it's not the Xavier Mansion. That's good.
Hybrid does look like a 70s space toy. That for sure looks like something you could have bought made out of rubber or whatever to fight Stretch Armstrong or something.
Exactly. I was just about to say, it looks like the alien bad guy of Stretch Armstrong that I left out in the winter one time and he got hard and cracked. Ultimately, Rom and the Evil Sisterhood have to team up to defeat Hybrid. And Torpedo was too injured from his encounter and was forced to rest at home the whole time. But Rom leaves Clairton again the next issue, with the Torpedo standing guard in his place, his family by his side supporting him. And that's how it would last for another year or so, until the fall of 1983, when the story of the Torpedo comes to a tragic end in ROM 49 and 50. Still Bill Mantlo and Sal Buscema, but now with Akin and Garvey inks.
Well, that's a pretty bloody cover on 49.
The story's ominously called Massacre.
Uh-oh.
And the Dire Wraiths, to get revenge on ROM, surround and attack Clairton, killing and replacing a lot of the townsfolk, including Brandy's parents.
Real good sense of menace in the pacing, everything in this one.
Yeah.
This is a real, I vaguely remember this comic from back in the day. The 49 has a really nice double page spread that starts to kind of, the idea of the invading monsters that can take your shape, you know, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, all that stuff, like well-trod ground, which made it perfect for Rom, who's already a space guy, to, you know, whine about Galador and all that.
And they use, like, these tendrils to, like, suck your brain out and then replace you. It isn't like they go into your body. It's like they really kill you and suck your brains. Brandy, who is, you know, has been Rom's human enabler, friend, and love interest.
Enabler.
Ended up in Starshine's dead armor when she was struck with a terminal situation. So, but that solved the problem. Now Rom could love her, and sorry, Steve, you're out of luck. They return to Clairton and check in with the Torpedo, and all is well, but it isn't. When the Wraiths are discovered, they cast a spell that banishes Rom and Starshine to a shadowy dimension, much like he banishes them to Limbo. And then to really top off and send you into anniversary issue 50, on the last page, beings that, to anyone who reads Marvel Comics for a long time, unless you think it's the Shaper of Worlds, would recognize that the Skrulls have landed and arrived.
Now, I forgot to say, I really like that the Wraiths use magic. That whole space and magic.
Yes.
I guess you could say Star Wars, sort of, with the Force and everything, but the idea that you can have, like, laser pistols and magic spells and everything is a great storytelling world to set things in.
Since the beginning, the Wraiths always had those shadow, like, pterodon bird demon things, and they had the hellhounds, and they had the sorcerers, and they have always been an arcane, hostile race. And now, with that really dark issue leading up to issue 50, how much were they bumming of the timing of things that issue 50 happens to be Assistant Editor's Month? And the tone of this book has, you know, does not in any way fall in line with the tone of the books that we usually associate with titles from that month in the fall of 83. This is way more somber because, I mean, it starts off with the Torpedo having a good day, Rom is back, and he can hang up his torpedoes for good and retire and stuff. He meets with some town folk, but the townsfolk tell him that the Wraiths are back, and he's like, no, 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 my visor would detect them. And then the townsfolk are like, well, but what if the Wraiths cast a spell on you to make you think you're still seeing humans? And he's like, maybe, I guess, that could. And then they drop the spell, and Brock looks on, and, like, the room is just full of Wraiths. Tragic.
Well done. Well done. Well, they really lay it on. Mercifully, Mantlo has dropped all the football stuff. Because that would have been a grim way to have this guy like, I'm scoring the last touchdown, and then he gets murdered would have been
sacked.
Away.
Sacked for a loss. He's sacked for a loss.
They did it well. Also, because it happens pretty early. Like, he gets to take out a few, but, like, stakes effectively raise. Like, this dude's dead. We're not even halfway through this issue. Like, this could be bad for Rom and Brandy / Starshine.
They don't even kill him from the front. Like, it's from behind. They suck his brain out. And, like, he's... I mean, that's it for the torpedo, Kevin.
Wow.
Yeah, we never see the character of the suit again.
Yeah, and then when the character shows up again, it's a different character that I think is an all-new one.
All right, but... This is kind of a cool thing about the Wraiths and the Skrulls and everything. So I'll just real shortly say that the Skrulls, you know, they arrive and they're looking for their enemy. And you're thinking it's like Rom or the Fantastic Four or something. But the enemy's the Wraiths. And they go door to door detecting and cleansing.
And I guess they don't like fellow shapeshifting rivals.
They get to Brock's house and kill him, revealing that he was a Wraith to his family. But his family, they get scanned, and they're all human. And they're left unharmed, which is interesting. I was wondering what happened to them.
Well, I think they don't want the Skrulls to kill, like, a bunch of little humans. Like, dude, that would be pretty grim.
The Rocketeers were shooting down school children a few issues before.
Yeah, but they're Wraiths. Like, they're the noted... There's no, like, we're going to redeem Skrulls. I mean, now maybe someone could write the story to Donny Cates is pitching how he's going to make the Wraiths the good guys and save the universe or something. But they were always the baddie baddies, which yeah, I like. Were. Like, no, some of these other aliens got a break, you know. Oh, maybe the cream, they're bad, but they might help you out. Or those stinking Skrulls may do you a favor or something like that. But Wraiths, nah, only good Wraith is a limboed Wraith.
That's for sure. And I like how the Wraiths have stuck around even after Rom, because that's totally that was never part of the toy and was always a Marvel concoction. Rom and Brandy escape that shadow dimension they were trapped in, and they return to Clairton just in time to be caught between the Skrulls and the Wraiths. And after the Skrulls' victory over the Wraiths with Rom and Starshine's help, the Skrulls reveal that the dire Wraiths are a deviant branch of Skrulls who got into arcane sorcery and, like, exiled, and they're seen as, like, a pox on the universe by the Skrulls, and along with Rom, they mean to wipe them out wherever they find them, and you're welcome. That's kind
of
cool.
You know, if they wanted to sprinkle some of these saga of Crystal Warriors in here, you know.
We got that in the Weird World thing a few years ago, remember, though?
It's true.
That was
kind of
cool. Wow, they revisited that stuff, and they did that exactly. But this was cool,
too,
because...
Hey, that toy line got to issue bad guys, too. Like, you could have bad toy. Like, the toys made it to bad guys, unlike the ROM, which is just ROM.
But Mantlo really tied the Wraiths even further into, you know, the Marvel Universe by making them offshoots of the Skrulls and everything, and... It was cool that the torpedo had his run there in Clairton for a couple of years of, you know, real time reading the comics. Like, he was around and every few issues would pop up for a few panels, still doing his thing. And it was like, ah, the torpedo. And then he was gone. And
then you started your letter writing campaign. Bring back the torpedo.
Well, it's hard. I did. Also, it's kind of funny that Marvel set this title like in a rural, small rural town in West Virginia. I always liked, you know, considering they were the home of New York City superheroes, it was fun to have Rom, the Galadorian Space Knight, in West Virginia.
It was, part of it was, I think, hiding it from the regular goings-on to some extent, but the other thing is it ties right into that whole, you know, Red Scare conspiracy type stuff that, you know, that we've been infiltrated into middle America, you know, small town, rural type stuff.
Well, I think horror works better there anyways. You know, I can think of some passages from like, there's a Sherlock Holmes story, The Copper Beeches, where Arthur Conan Doyle has the Sherlock character give a great speech about how bad the rural areas are compared to the vilest streets of London or nothing compared to the goings on out in the middle of nowhere.
But the Torpedo as a character, he had a pretty kooky little ride there, didn't he? Like, first being helmed by Wolfman, who tried to make more sense out of the original kooky story of getting the suit, and then why is he getting the suit, and then okay, the senator wants to make an army of guys in the rocket suits, and then when Mantlo picks up the helm, he ties it into their dire wraiths, and that suit is to fight Rom with, and I found it all to be very fun and comic booky at the time.
And I like the visual design of the suit. Like I said, the color maybe could spice it up. That visual design is very striking, especially when he's flying low to the ground. Those early Brown Jansen, kind of locked in that look of like, kind of like just this like street missile or something that fires and goes and fast.
And he looks like he's being pulled by his hands, doesn't he? I like that when his hands are out in front of him, and it's like the turbines on his hands are really pulling him. That's cool.
The classic kind of Superman flight mode, which was very dramatic. But my one regret, I guess, is I just don't know what he did before he was the Torpedo, Steve. Like,
he was a nobody.
His backstory.
How about you, Kevin? Was it, did it help embellish your appreciation of the suit's place in the Marvel timeline since you picked up on it when it was, you know, had like a hot babe body under it?
I mean, always the New Warrior one's going to be the one that's primary in my mind.
Even I admit she looks better in it. Come on. But it's kind of neat, right? That it went back to these old Daredevil issues and then got this whole big weird twist in Rom.
I mean, he's an all right minor character that had some appearances.
And then he was gone for 10 years until he popped up well, we'll figure out what's going on. How did she get the suit? Where'd it come from? What's going on? Well, hopefully we'll find out in future New Warrior installments. And what else is kind of neat is that these issues of Rom occur just before and after the issues we need to read to finish out our original Nova series segments. Like when Rom goes off into space, those are the issues where Mantlo sees another unfinished Marv Wolfman story to its finish. He was all about finishing up Marv's stuff. He was the after Marv.
And as a guy who really got into comics a lot in the 80s, I appreciated having Rom as like a tangential Marvel character. You get that first issue. He did interact with like the X-Men and Nova and these sort of characters, but he was kind of his own. Like, you didn't have to worry about the other stuff. You could really just be a big Rom head and not be caught up in all the goings on of what happened before. You know, got in on the ground floor, 75 issues of this crazy story, our Silver Surfer, you know, because I wasn't around in the 60s.
It was very Dark Hawk in a way where you could it could be like a good gateway book for like, here's what comics does. Here's a cool book, and you know, we'll give you little tastes of the rest of the universe, but the story's here.
And for all the limitations of the one bad guys, like, that also helps you introduce, like, it's like, oh, they're the you know, he's this guy and he fights those guys. That's a simple thing to latch onto. And as I said, they had, you know, the Mole Man and the Outcasts and all that we saw in this stuff. The Mole Man. Dude. He always makes me laugh.
Will he ever win? All right, let's wrap this up. Thank you, Andrew. Thank you, Kevin. I honestly wouldn't do it for long without you guys. And we will be back next episode for future fortuitous forays into fictional frivolity and fun. How about that?
Alliteration at its finest.
Until Rom burns the toast, make mine Marvel.
Oh, I was going to probably make some pun on Rom and Metroid.
Well, I think what they're going to do now that they got the Conan license back, they're going to have Rom versus Crom.
Oh, no. It's a Rom. Rom.
In the timbers up in Mario, the wolves are running round. The winter was so hot and cold, froze 10 feet beneath the ground. Don't murder me, I beg of you, don't murder me. Please don't murder me. I sat down to my supper, was a bottle of red whiskey. I said my prayers and went to bed. That's the last they saw of me. Don't murder me, I beg of you, don't murder me. Please don't murder me. When I awoke, the direwolf, 600 pounds of sin, was grinning at my window. All I said was, come on in. Don't murder me, I beg of you, don't murder me. Please don't murder me. The wolf came in, I got my cards, we sat down for a game. I cut my deck to the queen of spades, but the cards were all the same. Don't murder me, I beg of you, don't murder me. Please don't murder me. Don't murder me. Backwash up in Nario, the black and bloody mud. The dying wolf collects his due while the boys sing round the fire. Don't murder me, I beg of you, don't murder me. Please don't murder me. Don't murder me, I beg of you, don't murder me. Please don't murder me. No, 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 don't murder me. I beg of you, don't murder me.